Hi, everybody. I'm a recovered compulsive eater and a member of this group. My name is Gary and Haya. Boy, it's so nice to be talking amongst family and friends. You know, it used to be when there were face-to-face meetings, you only spoke with places you knew, and people have now been speaking, you know, in all these strange places and nobody I know. And you guys know me, so I kind of have to tell the truth for once. Anyhow, here's what happened. In 1988, I decided to commit suicide. And I had thought about it for years on and off here and there, but I had finally made a firm decision. I had a plan. I had the whole thing worked out, and I was going to commit suicide. And what the story was behind that was 5 years earlier, so this is like a movie now. It's 5 years before the opening scene where I'm about to commit suicide. What happens, I went on a diet. I went on one of those like healthy diets with a doctor and everything, and I lost 115 pounds. And after I lost 115 pounds, I flew around the country to show my family. Because in my family, if you're thin for 6 or 7 minutes, you run around and show everybody. So, you know, you're a good boy and you can say, I'm thin. And you know. So I went to New York. I was living in Ohio at the time. I was in grad school. And I flew to New York to show my father. And I showed him and he saw I was a good boy. And I remember I was staying at the Taft Hotel on 52nd Street, and I was walking back to the hotel. And after losing all this weight, I stopped off in a delicatessen, picked up, because I showed him I was thin, picked up what it was, even for me, an inordinate amount of food, and seemingly overnight gained back 130 pounds, just like that. There's this great line in the Hemingway novel where this guy goes bankrupt, and the main character says to him, how did you go bankrupt? And he says, two ways, gradually and then suddenly. And that's exactly what it was like. It was like gradually you gain a pound. Next thing you know, it's 130 pounds. And you're pounding the bar again, saying, how did this happen? So I gained back 130 pounds and then kept gaining and kept eating after that. But it was when I gained back the 130 pounds that I knew it was over. And I knew, way before getting here, I knew I was powerless over food. I've had this addiction as long as I can remember. And but the last 4 years after I gained back that 130 pounds, I had suffered from what Bill calls alcoholic torture before with regarding my food. But those 4 years were just years of complete misery. I had completely surrendered to my disease. I knew I could not stop eating. I surrendered to a future. I knew my future. I knew my future was going to be, one of those people who ended up in a hotel room somewhere, too obese to get out the door, and I was going to die in the room, and they'd have to cut open the door and pull me out with a wrench, like you see on TV sometimes. I knew that's where I was going, and I kind of surrendered to that future. I kind of surrendered to that being it. So here we are 4 years later, four years after gaining the weight back, 5 years after and I decided to commit suicide because I just couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take the anger. I couldn't take the torture. I couldn't take the just the hostility toward the world. Like, I had such self-loathing that it just made me hate everything. I just, aside from the weight, I couldn't take the hatred, just the depth of my self-hatred and my hatred for others. And so I decided to commit suicide. I was in academics professionally. So in academics, the year kind of starts in August. Like, August is like the beginning of the year. So I made a decision that if nothing changed by August, I would commit suicide. And I have no idea how this happened to this day. I still have no memory of how this happened. But on August 1st, 1988, I ended up in a treatment center for eating disorders. It was a Monday. I came in. I was 5'9" at the time. I'm not 5'9" anymore. I love oxymorons, and I have since grown shorter. I was 5'9". I stopped weighing myself at 340. So whatever it was over that. I came in with an anorexic, and she was also 5'9". I remember she was an emergency room nurse and she weighed 96 pounds. And we looked like the number 10 walking in the door. Like she was a straight little stick of a line, and I was as round as I was tall. And number 10, brought to you by Sesame Street and compulsive eating disorders. So I came to a treatment center, and they brought me that night to my very first OA meeting. And I didn't like the meeting very much. I thought it was very cutesy with the hugging. And there was this guy there named Hi, and he would say, "Hi, my name is Hi." And everybody would go, "Hi, hi," and kind of giggle. And I just thought that was just too corny. Like, it really wasn't for me. And but then I heard the speaker, and the speaker said something I had never heard before. And I had done every diet in the world, just like most of you. I had done everything there is to do and that I could think of. And the speaker talked about having the obsession removed. I had never heard that before in my entire life. And he had 10 months of absence at the time. I'll never forget. I thought 10 months was like, I remember thinking, he can't have what I have, because you can't have what I have and have 10 months. Jeff, his name was Jeff Graham. He became my first sponsor. But that idea of having the obsession removed, that stuck with me. And it still does. I knew then, as I know now, that if I could have the obsession removed, I have a shot. But the only shot I could have is if the obsession is removed. I know I can, like, I could diet. Well, I couldn't in those last 4 years. But even my last diet proved to me that I could diet, but that sooner or later, that obsession is going to beat me. So I heard that, and I decided right away that I was going to do this thing to the best of my ability. I threw myself into OA from the very beginning. And I am one of those people who had a love affair. I still have probably the longest pink cloud in OA history. I'm madly in love with OA, have been from the time I heard having the obsession removed. If you have what I have and you have a promise of having the obsession removed, holy mother of God, jeez, what a thing to promise me, having the obsession removed. So, just on the possibility I was in love, just on the thought of it, man. So my sponsor gave me these first step assignments to write my history about food. And when I looked at my history, it was really clear. I have this thing. I'm a compulsive eater. I have held food in my hand, crying, saying, please don't let me eat this. Please don't let me eat this. And eating it anyway. Once you've eaten against your will, once you know that you've eaten against your will, you can never say, I would never do anything, because I know, driven by the lash of compulsion, there's nothing I wouldn't do. There's absolutely nothing I wouldn't do of compulsion. Fortunately, my compulsion was with food. It could have been with things much worse. And I know compulsion could have me. Compulsion can beat me. I know that. There's another line from literature, but in Dante's Inferno, over one of the gateways in hell, there's a sign that says, after such knowledge, what forgiveness? Like, once you know this, how can you unknow it? How can you, I'll tell you my very favorite first step story is when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I was living in the Caribbean. My father, I come from a long line of criminals, and my father was hiding from the federal authorities and was living in the Caribbean. And I got in trouble and had to leave New York or go to jail. And so I was hiding in the Caribbean with my father. I was hiding from the state authorities. He was hiding from the federal authorities. And my father, it's not up to me to say somebody's a compulsive eater or not, but he certainly was. He certainly looked like it. Anyhow, he was going through a dieting period, and his way of dieting was to have no food in the house, none. So I was alone in the house, and there was no food, absolutely nothing. And I was having a carb craving, a real craving for carbs. And those of you who've had cravings know what that's like. So I was having this carb craving, and I had a thought. And it's worth noticing, like, in the third chapter of Morbid Alcoholism, there are four stories. If you count the jaywalker, there are four. And all four stories, it starts with a thought. The guy with the milk starts with, suddenly I had a thought. The jaywalker can't get the jaywalking idea out of his head. The guy with the milk and the slippers after the bottle and the slippers after 30 years suffered from the belief that, it all starts with a thought. So I had this thought. The thought was, we had nothing, no food, but we did have a German Shepherd. And the German Shepherd had milk bones, which are dog biscuits. And I had the thought. And that's why today I don't, like, if a food thought comes into my head, I don't romance the thought at all. As quickly as I can, I get rid of it, because I know, look at me, man. But if I sit in the barbershop long enough, I'm going to get a haircut. If I let that thought ruminate in there long enough, it's going to win. So I don't do that. Anyhow, I thought about the dog biscuits, and my first thought right away, you can't do that. That's disgusting, man. It's a dog biscuit. So I had a dog biscuit. You know, of course I ate one, and it really was disgusting. It really was every bit as terrible as I expected it to be. And the second one wasn't any better, nor the third, nor the fourth, nor the fifth. Some years later, the first time I told that story was at a beginner's meeting, and it was right in front of me, these women who I thought of as elderly women. They were probably younger than I am now, but I thought of as elderly women. When I told that story, they went like this. They went like that. Like I shocked them. And I was thinking, man, if you can shock people in OA, I mean, these are all people who have eaten out of garbage cans and stuff, like, and they're shocked. So on the way out, I was talking to my friend Maxine, and I said, Max, you know, like, is that really disgusting? Because I don't know, my disgust on meat is kind of broken. And she said it's only disgusting if you had to wrestle them away from the dog. Because here's the thing, and I know it sounds kind of funny to say all this, but the real point is I wouldn't have done that if I had any choice at all. You know, nobody eats dog biscuits with choice. I sponsored a guy who weighed 700 pounds. Nobody weighs 700 pounds by choice. Nobody says, when I grew up, I want to eat dog biscuits and weigh 700 pounds. That's why it's a first, that's what makes it a first step story. You know, that's how I knew I was powerless over food, that I did something I definitely did not want to do. I would have done anything to not do other than experience the slight pain of a craving and sitting through a craving. So I knew the first step. I knew I was powerless over food and my life had become unmanageable. So my sponsor and I then got to the second step, and this is where the rubber kind of hits the road. It's like, do you want to do this thing or don't you? And I got to this step, you know, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I wasn't really an atheist. I wasn't really an agnostic. I wasn't really, and I wasn't a believer. What I was I was just obnoxious. I was just obnoxious as some of you know me now, and I'm pretty obnoxious. I was really obnoxious. I was going to argue with you, whatever side you were on. Like, if you believed in God, I was going to argue why there's no God. If you didn't believe in God, I was going to argue why there's a God. My sponsor, of course, believed in God. So I was arguing with him why there's no God. All the stuff that your sponsees tell you, all the nonsense, you know, the Holocaust and cruelty and man, and all that stuff and science and the Big Bang and yada, yada, yada. And my sponsor said something to me that was so important that I always like to pass on to people, especially if you're a newcomer, especially if you're rallying around with the second step. He said, I don't give a hoot what you believe. He used the word hoot, but you get the gist of the idea for those of you who speak, you know, French. He said, I don't give a hoot what you believe. He said, you're an active addict. So God hasn't chosen to reveal the nature of the cosmos to you, Moses. He said it just like that, like, who do you think you are? And it's such a brilliant point, because none of us would go over to an active heroin addict with the needle hanging out of his arm and say, by the way, Mr. Heroin Addict, what is the nature of the cosmos? Is there a God? Is there an afterlife? Tell me your theology. You know, like, none of us would do that. But compulsive eaters are so arrogant. We don't see ourselves as addicts. So we think our opinion on the nature of the universe matters. He said to me, look, if you want to get well, you come to believe in a power greater than yourself. The people who have done this, this is what they've done. You want what we have, do what we do. And I made a decision. I made a decision to come to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And that's the main thing, that, you know, the book doesn't say, a lot of us say that you can believe in anything, and that's not true. What the book says is it has to be a power greater than yourself. And it has to be a power that can solve your problem. If it cannot solve your problem, it's the wrong higher power. And that's essential. It can solve my problem. So I made a decision to believe in that. And it wasn't that hard a decision. I believed in crazier things. I believed that Judy Levine really loved me. And the number of times I believed, you know, that stripper really likes me, the number of times I believed that, I can't tell you. Yeah? Like, sort of believe, like, and I was also taught, and I don't mean to offend anybody by this, but I was taught, if you're not even willing to believe in a power greater than yourself, if you're not even willing, it simply means you want to eat more than you want to get well, that you want to be in control more than you want to surrender. That's all it means. It's not a big deal. It's natural for a compulsive eater. or it's natural for an addict to want to use. Could you imagine going over to somebody with late stage cancer or tuberculosis and they're on their way out? And you say, listen, to get well, all you have to do is believe in the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy. Could you imagine him saying, no, I'd rather die. No, I'd rather be in misery. In the big book, it says the decision to believe or not believe is often a weighty issue, but it's only a weighty issue for late stage addicts. If you're dying and the way out is to believe in something greater than yourself, it doesn't even have to be God. Mine is God. Now, you're not even willing, man. That tells you something. You know, that tells you something about your relationship to food. Anyhow, I'm preaching instead of sharing. So we came to the third step. And here's what happened. I get a little bit emotional about the third step. I was on my knees, and I didn't really believe in God. In fact, at meetings, I would say God, but I always had this feeling that I wanted to run around and tell you what I meant by God. By God, I meant cosmic energy, and I had all this stuff. I didn't want you to think I was one of those people who believed in, you know. I was on my knees talking to God. And in my treatment center, there was this woman named Mallory. I think Blythe might have known her. She was like, she had just come back from India. So I knew she was holy because apparently, you know, God lives in India. I don't know if you knew that, but God lives in India. He visits Brooklyn now and then, but he really lives in India. And she had come back from India and she was wearing like Birkenstocks and a lot of linen and kind of floating around the treatment center. So I knew she was spiritual. So I got on my knees and I said, God, I'm a friend of Mallory's. Because I wanted him to know that I knew somebody. I wasn't just some schmuck showing up late in the game. And I said, God, I'm a friend of Mallory. And then I started praying. And even though I didn't really believe yet, I don't even know where the words came from. Because they're not the kind of words I use. What I said is, God, if it be your will, please redeem me. Please make me new. And redemption isn't part of my lexicon. It's not something I grew up with. I don't know where that came from. But I asked God to redeem me. And here's what happened. He did. I don't know why. Grace is considered an unmerited gift. Grace of God is an unmerited gift. And I certainly did not earn it. If life were fair, my life would be much worse than it is today. But for whatever reason, he redeemed me. And he redeemed me by giving me the willingness to work through the rest of the 12 steps and to live a 12-step way of life. In our book, you know, in the big book, it says sometimes a great effect is felt at once in the third step. And I was one of those. It wasn't just that things looked different. It was like the decision to live by spiritual principles, that decision alone changed me so thoroughly. It was so, you know, it was such a different come from in life than I had previously known. I'd always looked to see what I can get away with. And suddenly I thought I had a getting problem, that I wasn't getting enough from life. And I take the third step and discover that I have a giving problem. I wasn't giving enough to life. And that changed everything for me. And in our book, in the third step, it says, once you truly take the third step, you cannot help but recover. What a great promise. What a great promise. If you truly take the third step, you cannot help but recover. But then it's not just some airy-fairy promise, because what it says after that is, if you take that step, God will lead you through the rest of the 12 steps. And that's exactly what happened to me. And I have a joyous, wonderful, just I am one happy camper coming from the misery I was coming from, suicidal misery. Some of you know me, and I'm like, people say, how are you? And I always say pretty wonderful, because I'm pretty wonderful, man. Things are really good. So just in closing, I would say, God, this program and you people have not just saved my life, but you've given me a life worth living. You have given me a life that is useful and given me, most importantly, a place to be useful. So thank you so much. And if I could ever return the favor, if there's anything I do to return the favor, please let me know. And thank you for letting me babble on all this time.